Welcome to Free Thoughts from Libertarianism.org and the Cato Institute. I'm Aaron Powell.
And I'm Trevor Burrus.
And joining us today is Deirdre McCloskey. She's Emerita Distinguished Professor of Economics and of History and Professor of English and Communications at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's the author of many books, most recently Bourgeois Equality, How Ideas, Not Capital or Institutions, Enriched the World. Welcome to Free Thoughts.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
So with this last book, Bourgeois Equality, you've reached the end of your Bourgeois Era trilogy.
Yes.
And these are three big
Praise
books.
Praise the Lord.
These three books, big books, I mean, to say they cover a lot of ground would I think be to understate the matter a bit. For our audience who has not waded into all three or even one of them yet, can you give us a thumbnail sketch?
Sure. The three are a defense of what is unfortunately called capitalism. And it's a full bore defense. It's not just economic, although I think you can make a very good economic case in favor of capitalism, but it's social and political as well. And the kinds of evidence that I use range from quantitative economic calculations right through Shakespeare and Jane Austen.
That's clearly a gamut. I'm just trying to say, clearly I know what goes in between those two things. Is that like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Is that on that continuum?
Exactly.
So what are you trying to explain in these
books?
Well,
I'm trying to explain modern economic growth, the most important secular event in human history, is that in 1800, the average person on the planet earned in modern Washington, D.C. Prices $3 a day, earned and spent $3 a day. And now the average American earns and spends $130 a day in the same prices.
What's the world average?
The world average is 33. It's about the same as Brazil's income per head. So think of Brazil as the average. China is about $20 a day. India about 10. So, and this is just an immense improvement. And it's the central question, as the blessed Adam Smith said, the nature and causes of the wealth of nations.
What does it mean to say that someone lives on $3 a day versus $33 a day?
130.
For Americans.
Or say 33 for the world average.
Yeah, but so when we're talking about how the world for most of its history lived on $3 a day, that means that they were – on an average day, they purchased what we – an amount of stuff equaled what we today could buy for $3.
That's right. And so it allows for inflation.
Okay.
It allows for exchange rates. I mean these figures are very rough, of course. But the order of magnitude is not in doubt, and there's no economic historian who will contradict the rough order of magnitude involved. It's an amazing change, and there was nothing like it in the glory of Greece and grandeur of Rome and Song China and the Italian Renaissance. You might get a doubling, but this isn't a doubling. This is a factor of 30.
And that
2,900%.
That fact has been – people have tried to explain this before. I mean, you said economists are aware of this fact. It's a hockey stick, as you say. And that fact is – I mean, as you said, even Adam Smith thought that this was an interesting question of why are nations wealthy.
Although I must say the sharp awareness of the hockey stick, the amazing – the blade of the hockey stick shooting up, that's rather recent. That's in the last – say half century or so that people have really seen, oh my God, it's that high?
Yeah, so it's a thing my dad once pointed out to me that if you were to take a time machine from maybe 1000 BC, if you were an average person living in 1000
sure.
BC and you took a time machine to 1400 AD –
yeah.
In say England,
it's pretty much the
you
same.
would not have that much.
You would not be shocked.
To I mean maybe some
the fashions would look
fashions
funny.
Would look different, but it's still toil is the
yeah,
name of the
right.
game.
Exactly.
Most
and
people can't read and
early death, unable to read, eating a very narrow and unhealthy diet. Housing is terrible. It's a hut with a hole in the roof for the smoke. worldwide, everywhere. And then there's a tiny group of kings and so on, priests, who might live better than that. But even Louis XIV, the Sun King, in Versailles in 1700, you know, he was subject to smallpox. When he rode around in his carriage, it was bumpy. and people who waited on him in the Great Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, there were no bathrooms. There were no bathrooms in Versailles. So if you had to heed the call of nature, you went out into the stairs and peed.
Now, the king didn't do that, though.
The king didn't do that. He had a special place where he would pee with all his dukes around him to help him pee.
So that was his great wealth difference between
– That's – in fact, yes. In fact, there's been an awful lot of talk about inequality recently, and it's I think it's deeply foolish, because the real inequality was in 1800 and before. Rich people in the 18th century in Europe would have orangeries. That is, in their backyard, they had a backyard, they'd have orange trees and lemon trees and so on. And so they didn't get scurvy. Whereas if you were a poor person subsisting on black bread, you could get scurvy because you weren't getting enough vitamin C.
So this growth then, you over the trilogy, you're giving your argument for why and how this happened, which is it's a subtle and really interesting argument and cause. But it's this. You're not the first to tackle this question.
No, to put it mildly. As I said, back to Adam Smith and Marx and all Schumpeter, all the great economists and historians have faced this question.
So then prior to Deirdre McCloskey coming on the scene, what are the stories that are typically given or most accepted for
there are two. There's one on the left, which is Marx and others, which is that the great enrichment, as I call it, of the 19th century was caused by exploitation. The slave trade, for example, which has become popular again among young historians, or simply exploitation of the workers. You then take the so-called surplus value and you invest it in machines, and that causes the modern world. So that's the left side. On the right, it's about virtuous capital accumulation. You abstain from consumption, as we economists say, and then use that money to invest in ports and carriages and houses and machines. They both of these explanations depend, in a sense, on the very word capitalism, which, as I said earlier, is not a very good word describing what the history of the last two centuries has been. The problem is that sheer piling of bricks on bricks, or even university bachelor's degrees on university bachelor's degrees, reaches diminishing returns very quickly. You can build a factory, and then you can build another one next door, and then, hey, let's do a third one and a fourth one. You can see that this is not going to work out.
Well, you don't get the exponential.
You don't get the exponential. What you do is you get declining returns on the next brick, and it declines and declines and declines. John Maynard Keynes pointed out that without innovation, you could drive the interest rate down to zero in a generation or two. So it can't be just accumulation. And in any case, humans have always accumulated. I mean, they accumulated Acheulean hand axes by the hundreds when they were in the caves. And the Chinese built the Great Wall and then built the Grand Canal and so on. So in investment, whether it comes from exploiting the poor or from virtuous savings, can't be the key. What has to be the key is innovations. I call them market-tested betterments. That is, an idea like the railway, which is a combination of rails that they used in coal mines to move the carts with coal in them to the head of the mine, with a high pressure steam engine, not the great big slow things, atmospheric engines, but high pressure. And you combine those two, and suddenly you have railways. And there's been this amazing burst of innovation since 1800. And my explanation is not this capital accumulation idea or even institutional change, but my idea is that there was an ideological change and that people started admiring market-tested innovation or indeed admiring markets much more than they had before. And that made everyone bold. It made the ordinary person think, gee, I can invent a cherry core. I'm a orchardman in Wisconsin in the 19th century with a lot of time on my hands in the winter. And I can invent still another cherry core, taking the – not core, pitter, taking the pit out of the cherry. And so you get this just amazing screw propellers, the bandsaw, the electric motor, the internal combustion engine, blah, 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 blah.
So a merchant in – I mean I'll choose a time and you can correct me, but let's say 1250.
Yeah.
Is not respected or
not at all.
Also not respected unless they're doing maybe inventing a new stirrup for the horse for the charge.
That's right.
Or
exactly.
For the longbow.
Exactly. For military innovations were admired. The very word innovation, as you can see if you look at the history of the word in the Oxford English Dictionary, is a bad word until the 1800s. In the 1700s and before, oh no, geez, let's not innovate. God, that would change things. It would disturb the great chain of being from king to family dog. No, no, we can't do this. And it only becomes a positive word. We all think that innovation is grand. No one in the last 100 years have thought that innovation is a bad idea, although actually some of our friends on the left
are starting to think that.
Well, they've actually always thought that mechanization causes unemployment, which it doesn't.
Is there a difference between thinking innovation as a general concept or as something that happens in the abstract is good or bad versus how you respond to on-the-ground individual innovations?
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking like to mention our friends on the left, like they in general if you ask young people on the left like, yeah, innovation
sure,
is great. But then when there's
on
the ground like, well, we're going to replace taxi cabs with Uber, that's bad.
And in Germany they've outlawed Uber. Yeah, the problem is protectionism. And you can call it lots of names. You can call it mercantilism. You can call it don't do it in my backyard.
NIMBYism, yes.
You can call it all kinds of things, and it's the impulse to protect John from the competition of Janice. And in fact, American progressivism 100 years ago did protect John from Janice, made it much harder for women to be employed, and that was on purpose. It was to protect middle-aged white males, Native Americans, against the women and the immigrants and the blacks and the young people who might compete against them. So that's been one – as you point out, it's kind of a tension on the left because the left – I mean Marx was a great – had a great vision of improvement. of innovation. He believed that the bourgeoisie and capitalism, as he called it, were the great were these great improving forces in history, and then that socialism would be plucked as the ripe fruit from this capitalist society. But his followers have gone back to a much earlier version of economic thinking, namely protect, protect, protect. And the way I explain it to my students is I say, look, okay, you want to be protected against Mexico? Why don't we protect Chicago against the rest of the world? Why don't we protect the South Loop against the rest of the world? Indeed, why don't we protect my house against the rest of the world, and I'll make all my own stuff and I'll be fully employed? And then they can kind of see that this is a crazy vision of the future.
So I want to try and connect these two ideas, because I'm still trying to figure out, and I think these are connected. So merchants and businessmen, and it's an equality of a certain type, middle yeah. class, the bourgeois, and the
bourgeoisie.
In Middle Ages have a different level of esteem, if no esteem at all.
Yeah,
and innovation has little esteem. But your contention is that it's not that people started inventing and then got esteem.
Yeah.
Or becoming merchants and then got esteem by bringing more wealth. It's that they first got esteem and then started bringing it, or was it more contemporaneous than that?
No, it's they first got esteem and then they did well. But of course, there's some feedback.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you can see this in the talk in the early 18th century in England, where merchants are rising in prestige. It's perfectly plain, and one of the arguments is precisely that it's a kind of mercantilist argument. It's a kind of protectionist military type argument that the profits and the prosperity coming from the merchants makes England and then Britain stronger in every way. And so there is feedback. Look, if this what I call bourgeois revaluation hadn't happened, if it hadn't resulted in economic success in this explosion of income in the 19th century, we would not be talking about how wonderful it is. In fact, then it took quite a while into the 19th century for trade-tested betterment to massively pay off for the working class is the origin of socialism.
So the protectionism thing, I wanted to like try and tie this, because one thing that I thought when I was reading your first volume years ago was an idea that I had about that one of the most important things that had to happen for markets to thrive was mm-hmm. that you had to believe that certain types of harms were not actionable or morally wrong. So competitive harms. I mean, this is clearly a harm. You run a butcher.
Absolutely.
Someone comes in and starts a butcher, puts you out of business, maybe puts your family on the street.
I publish a book, and I hope that Bob Gordon's book does worse.
Yeah. So, but we think that it's all in the game. It's something like this
that's
sort
right.
of thing, and that's a really important idea.
John Stuart Mill is very explicit on this. In On Liberty, he says in a sentence which I can't exactly reproduce, the state should not take an interest in complaints of people against competitors. Unless the competitors are using force or fraud, then the criminal law and the laws of contract and property should be brought to bear. But aside from that, if someone builds a better mousetrap and you're in the mousetrap industry and you don't get it, too bad for you. And it's a massive change to have that ethic.
Well, that's why I think there's always this tension. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, there's we always have to talk about Trump in this day and age. But most competition is tough and very unforgiving.
Yeah.
And a lot of government has done a lot of things throughout history to just protect people from competition.
Absolutely.
But before we even understood, you know, that was the way I kind of, the very broad view, the only thing government was for in the mercantilist, just to protect people
exactly.
from competition.
Exactly
to foster
right.
markets, you need to get people to start thinking that competitive harms are not more actionable.
That's exactly
in,
right.
In that way. So that
it's, indeed, it would be interesting, and I don't know this enough. I don't know the history of the common law well enough. I believe that the common law has never viewed competition of that character as actionable.
Yeah, it had to be unfair.
I mean, right from the beginning, it had to be violence or fraud of some sort.
Is even this change part of this change in the respect we paid to the middle class, to
yeah.
the merchants? Because I can see, like, thinking about the way that we talk about competitive harm
yeah.
today, it seems like when the person who you are in competition with
mm-hmm.
and who is harming you is someone that you respect,
yeah.
that you believe in the dignity of, then we seem to think it's okay,
yeah.
whether that's like the merchant
right.
down the street or the other sports team, and we've got the good sportsmanship.
That's right.
As long as it's not the Jets, it's
but
fine.
When,
yes, this is Aaron's inveterate hatred for and the Yankees. Yes, I'm down with that.
But when it seems to switch over to that same sort of competitive harm becomes wrong, impermissible,
yeah.
immoral when it's done by someone we don't
yeah.
respect,
well,
like Trump's
that's
Mexicans
that's
and Chinese.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I say in this new book. I speak of the two equalities. The book is called Bourgeois Equality, which is a somewhat surprising title for a free market person to use. But what I mean by bourgeois equality is equality before the law. That's essential, but it's not sufficient. Because exactly as you say, you need equality of social dignity, or else the equality before the law is eroded. The history of European Judaism is a case in point, where in the 18th and 19th centuries, in all the countries of Western Europe at least, Jews get equality before the law. But they don't, in most countries, get equality of dignity. This is the point that Hannah Arendt makes. And so you see the result. The equality before the law was abandoned in the 1930s in lots of countries.
Well, that's super interesting because what comes from that seems to be because Jews created so many institutions of economic cooperation because
yeah.
they had a deficit
yeah.
in dignity even if they were on par.
That's right. Well,
in the
law. You know, for very good reasons they were nervous about their Christian neighbors. Interestingly, as we've come to know, their neighbors in the Islamic world were much less hostile to the Jews than were the Christians. But the key is equality. And to use another somewhat surprising word, the key idea that is very radical in the 17th century, somewhat radical in the 18th century, and becomes less and less so in the 19th and 20th century is liberalism. The in the sense of – not in the modern American sense but in the root sense and in the sense it's still used in most of the world, namely worthy of a free person – a free person is equal before the law and is equal in dignity. And this kind of equality, not equality of result, which I call French equality in honor of Rousseau and Thomas Piketty. Not French equality of outcome, end state equality, as it's been called, but equality of opportunity.
So then the structure of this argument though, let me ask about this because it's a trilogy of books and the story that you're trying to tell as you described to us is why this economic growth happened and that it happened as a result of a rhetorical shift and a shift in the
in ethics and ideology and rhetoric.
But then the first volume of the trilogy is – how does it then fit into the argument? Because it, that one you are reviving an ethical tradition and explaining it. So what is that ethical tradition and why is that step necessary to then books two and three?
Well, I think it's necessary, although when you write a book over 10 years, a series of books, and you're thinking about them for 20 years as I have been, your ideas are bound to shift, at least I hope so, because you should be learning stuff as you go. And in the first book, I was simply trying to establish that there are commercial versions of the traditional virtues that you can attribute to modern market-tested betterment, as I eventually came to call it, or to capitalism. So I was trying to show that the sneering at the bourgeoisie, which is so common, it's just reflexive in most people in the West and the East, for that matter, is his big mistake, and that we should honor innovators and merchants and people buying low and selling high. So it was part of the continuing sub-theme of all three books, which is against socialism, against, Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, in many ways a wonderful man, said that to buy low and sell high is the worst possible thing that you could do. And this is crazy because buying ideas low and selling them high is how the economy innovates. If we're not going to make a profit that is then eroded by entry of the sort that John Stuart Mill said wasn't actionable, then if you don't have that, you don't have any progress at all and you stay at $1, $2, or $3 a day, which is essentially what Gandhi wanted.
Now, how does this relationship work with political institutions? Is it first we have to have relative freedom, I would say, for merchants
crucial.
To even if it was illegal to be a merchant, it'd be very hard to get people to start respecting merchants.
That's right. If the state is constantly intervening in the economy in various ways, it's not going to work out.
So were there certain places where there was a fertile political environment for this to happen?
Well, for example, the first place in Northern Europe where it happened on a big scale was in Holland, and this happens in the 16th and 17th century. By the end of the 17th century, the English are so tired of fighting the Dutch as they did three times and being outsmarted by them in trade many times. They finally become Dutch practically, the English do. They get a Dutch king.
They get a Dutch king, yes.
They get a Dutch king. They adopt a Dutch stock market. They adopt a Dutch national debt. My only surprise is that they didn't adopt the Dutch language. But that's when England starts becoming bourgeois. 100 years before, in Shakespeare's time, everyone is against the bourgeoisie, against buying low and selling high, against innovation, against trade is thievery. And it shows in Shakespeare's plays. None of which even the Merchant of Venice praises commerce.
And so the Dutch do you try to go back further than that in the sense of – and at some point how long you can bring an explanation back, like why Holland, like what was happening.
Yeah.
It was the Hanseatic League had been there in the Middle Ages, trading was a part of their – was a more part of their blood
well, and
than
indeed,
other places.
There's certainly the Hansa and then there's there's no – Northern Italy with its merchant republics, which except for Venice gradually became non-republics. And there's Barcelona, a town I know and love. which has a long history in the 12th and 13th century of a merchant town, a town that's into this. But the scale of the Low Countries, not just what's now called Holland, but also Belgium, and then the scale of England taking this over, and Scotland then eventually, and then the English American colonies taking over this liberal idea that any person should be equal before the law. Now don't get too excited about this, because these are in the what became the United States. This is a slaveholding society. The man who wrote "All Men Are Created Equal" enslaved his own son by Sally Heming. So it's not altogether. It's not complete equality, and indeed the notion of equality that's born in full political form among, say, the levelers in the English Revolution or Civil War of the 1640s is one that keeps being expanded in the West. And now we have equality for transgendered people. I mean, I never thought I'd see such a thing. And gay marriage and women's liberation and the liberation of colonial people and on and on and on.
Are there historical examples where these things don't go together, where we have the liberalism without the respect for the middle class, or the other way around?
Well, I wouldn't define a society that doesn't have respect for commoners. It's not just the bourgeoisie. It's all commoners. Because how are you going to refresh the middle class, the merchants class or the inventors class, if not from the working class? So you have to – all people have to be empowered. All people have to, be, in the English phrase, be allowed to have a go. So I wouldn't call a society that doesn't empower people that way a liberal society. For example, we think highly of Athens, and I do too. There are lots of people who have this odd affection for Sparta. And I really don't get that.
The status of the ultimate status society. Yes.
I know they love Sparta. They think, boy, that's a grand idea. When we're everyone's.
They haven't had to eat their food.
Well, I mean, everyone's a serf, even the Spartanate.
Or kill their babies.
Even the free warriors are confined. Anyway, that's not Athens up the coast. Yet Athens was a slave society. Yet women were absolutely unfree. Yet, if you were a foreigner, you couldn't vote. Yet. So that wasn't a liberal society. It was a commercial society. There's no question about it. What made Athens strong was its commerce. So you can have commercial success and not get all the way to this modern idea. There's a great statement by Rumboldt, a leveler who was hung by James II, I believe, in the 1680s. As he was facing the hangman, he said, "I think there is no man and also no woman, dear, who is born superior to another. For none comes into the world with a saddle on his back, and none comes booted and spurred to ride him." And that radical idea that every human is equal, not equal again in the French way, but equal in dignity and before the law, took a long time to come on the scene, and that's what made us rich.
So to recapitulate, then the flow chart, as you see it, I mean, some things are pretty contemporaneous with understanding that they're feedback loops.
Yeah, that's how I think is flow charts.
So the flow chart begins with – what would be the first – so how do you get to the great enrichment? It begins with what – does it begin with dignity or
– here's what I claim. And this is a little unsatisfactory, but it has the misfortune of being correct, so I have to say it, which is that there were accidents of European politics from the Reformation on that accidentally made people think that they could have a go. Let's take the Reformation itself, 1517, Martin Luther and all that. It's not so much his Reformation as what's known as the Radical Reformation, the Anabaptists eventually in England in the next century, the Quakers, or the Congregationalists, the Puritans.
What about Calvinists too?
Calvinists, but only if they were the Congregationalists. That is, if they believed that the congregation should choose the minister, not some hierarchy.
Some of these are very eschatological. You're talking about this at lunch.
They are
the Anabaptists are unbelievably.
They are indeed. That's why it's Cromwell who invites the Jews back into England, who had been expelled in the 13th century, because he believes that England is the new Jerusalem. And this resounds down to this day in the affection of radical Protestants for Israel. But in any case, this matter, it's not what Max Weber said, which was the doctrine of salvation changed. That's not my argument, and I think it's his argument's wrong and has been shown to be wrong over and over again since it was written in 1905. But what's really going on is church governance makes people feel empowered.
When it becomes more democratized.
More democratized. And the extreme example again is English Quakers, in which women and men were equal in the meeting. And there was no minister at all. And they just sat around and waited for the Holy Spirit to
– as friends, yes.
to descend on them, as friends. And the very phrase, the society of friends, is crucial here. And that kind of equality is what made the modern world. And no surprise, an astonishingly high percentage of Quakers – excluded from Oxford and Cambridge, so there were certain occupations they couldn't go into. But an astonishingly high percentage of English Quakers, an extremely small group, were successful in business. Cadbury's chocolate, Roundtree's chocolate, just to begin with, were Quaker enterprises.
So we had this increasing respect for merchants and the people who were innovating.
Well, actually, I want to clarify because actually that's the question. Is that the domino? I mean, if you're saying
that's
like
that's before the
merchant respect,
well before the Great Enrichment, which is really the 19th century.
So would it be would the first domino be like the printing press leading to church reformation leading to equality?
I speak of the four R's: reading, Reformation, revolt, by which I mean specifically the Dutch revolt against Spain, 80 years, which ended in 1648, and revolution. The English Civil War / revolution of the 1640s, the American Revolution, and the French Revolution. All of those could have gone the other way very easily. If Charles I and Archbishop Laud had been not such jerks, the English Revolution wouldn't have happened. It added to that 1688, the so-called Glorious Revolution when, as I said before, England became Dutch. Add all those together and you have accidental, contingent events that came out in a way that made people bold. And what the historical job here, to the scientific job, is to then compare Europe after 1517 with other societies at the time. And it just so happened, for example, that China, which was a very advanced society economically and technologically, way in advance of Europe in 1600 or even 1700, it just so happened that under the Qing and even earlier under the Ming, but especially under the Qing after 1644, was very conservative, very hostile to innovation. There's a famous event in the 1790s. The English king, George III, sends scores of boxes of machinery to the Chinese emperor as a gift, telescopes and steam engines and so on. And the emperor, or at least the emperor's man, replies to the king of England, "Thank you very much, but we're in no need of gadgets."
Well, this then brings me back to my question, which is, does it matter who in the society is respectful or if everyone is? Because so there's the date that looms large throughout these books, which is 1848.
Yeah.
And that's when you date the beginning of the cultured classes, the intellectuals,
the clerisy
disdaining innovation and merchants and capitalism. But we have, I mean, between 1848 and now, there's been an awful lot of economic growth.
Well, yeah, that's right. And so why did I write the books? Because I'm terrified that the clerisy's position, Bernie Sanders is a nice example, but so on the other side.
And his fans. You're saying, and the professors and people who are fans of him.
And the professors and the intellectuals on the left, but indeed also Donald Trump and that kind of person on the right, if he's really on the right. They're very dangerous. But by now, ordinary people have bought into what I call the bourgeois deal. You let me, a bourgeois, innovate and start a new factory. And in the long run, I'll make you rich. That's the deal. Art Cardin and I are going to write or have written and are going to soon publish a popular version of the three volumes, which we're going to call Let Me Do It and I'll Make You Rich, The Bourgeois Deal. And that's what happened. And that's what's protected us since 1848 against these terrible ideas. Nationalism, socialism, both ideas in the minds of intellectuals, journalists, think tanks. And then if you like those two, nationalism, socialism, maybe you'll like national socialism, Nazism. So that's why I wrote the books, is to hold back this tide of left and right utopianism.
Do you think that – you talk about growth, as you said, the great enrichment and the rates of growth.
Yeah.
John Cochran – John H. Cochran, who's Stanford in today's Wall Street Journal actually, wrote about – because the GDP growth rate came out for 2016 is 0.5%.
Yeah, that's nice.
So he said from 1950 to 2000, this is quoting John H. Cochran, the U.S. economy grew at an average rate of 3.5% annually. Since 2000, it has grown at half that rate, 1.76%. Mm-hmm. Even in the years since the bottom of the Great Recession in 2009, which should have been a time of fast catch-up growth, the economy has only grown at 2%. Is this some people will read this and be like, well, I mean, growth. OK, what's the big – we're all pretty rich. Why is growth so important? Or are these differences in numbers scary? And so is this kind of thing scary? Do you think that these – that we're starting to paralyze the growth through some methods?
Well, you can kill it. You can paralyze growth. Europe in the common market has done an excellent job of this with absurd regulations. The new Treaty of Rome, this is the central question in the vote in Britain in June about whether or not to stay in the common market. The new Treaty of Rome created a big free trade area, which was a very good idea. But then Brussels has decided to level the playing field, as they keep saying.
Mercantilize it, basically.
That's mercantilizing. They're gonna protect. Turns out that they end up protecting France and Germany. Surprise, surprise. But okay. No, I think that this sky is falling rhetoric that you hear these days from even Cochrane, I'm very surprised, but from Bob Gordon and even Tyler Cohen, who I wouldn't have expected it from, is premature. I think that we mismeasure growth. We don't include enough of the changes in quality. We can't measure them very well. When was the last time you changed an automobile tire? A very long time ago. Things have improved, and the consumer price index that you use to get real growth doesn't adequately allow for this improvement quality. But what's more important is that the rest of the world, China and India in particular, are growing like mad because they're liberalizing. They're not, in the Chinese case, in politics, but they're moving against mercantilism and towards free trade inside and outside. And that is going to spread through the demonstration effect, if nothing else. It'll become more and more obvious that the way forward is liberalism. And that will make the rest of the world, which, as I said, is about $33 a day, which, by the way, was the American income in 1940. The average income in the United States was $33 a head in 1940. Now it's $130 a head per day. There's been, as Cochrane points out, a big improvement since then. So I think it's way premature to say that the end is near. There was a cartoon in the New Yorker not too long ago, which showed a bearded man walking away down the street with a sign he held, "The end is near." And this couple who had seen him, one says to the other, "You know, that was Paul Krugman."
So we at the Cato Institute, our mission is to promote the very ideas that you are promoting, to spread the notion that that trade and innovation and capitalism and markets,
free societies
are the ways to improve the state of humanity while respecting people's dignity.
Sure.
But I saw a poll just a few days ago that was asking supporters of various political candidates about their views on free trade. First, the overall numbers of people who thought that free trade was overall good were low.
Which free is foreign trade.
Yes. But what was really striking was that every single one of the Republican candidates, supporters polled lower on this than the Democratic candidates.
Isn't that shocking?
And so we've been – I mean, we're used to having this – to promoting the ideas to the clerisy. We're used to this argument of, no, look, it's, you know, you've misunderstood markets.
Yeah.
Socialism doesn't work for these reasons. We can show you the historical stuff. But how do we tell this story, sell this bourgeois deal of, let me get rich right now and over time I'll make you rich, to the people on the opposite end from the clerisy, the ones who are, say, supporting Trump now, who are saying, yeah, that sounds like a fine deal, except I don't have the time. Like my family, you know, I can't find work. My kids can't find work. I'm hurting right now. And what you're saying is, hey, I'm going to get rich and then I promise in a generation or two it's going to pay off.
Yeah. Well, it in fact pays off much quicker than that. But what people need to understand, and they don't, is that international trade has very little to do one way or the other with American prosperity. American prosperity. This is a very big country. And most of the lost jobs in Pittsburgh or in Detroit were lost to other Americans, not to a bunch of Mexicans and Canadians and Japanese and so forth. So foreign free trade, I approve of it. They'll take back my economist card if I don't. But what is really important is internal free trade. And it's internal free trade, to go to your point, that's being leaned on with excessive regulation and foolish taxation such as the corporate income tax. So I am how to persuade them. One way is to get more radical in some ways in the liberal. I want to stop calling myself a libertarian. I'm a Christian libertarian, but I'm going to start calling myself a Christian liberal. And what we should be saying is, look, the purpose of the Cato Institute is to make poor people rich. That should be its purpose. And that is its purpose, because its program does make poor people rich. And if we were to say things like, let's have a negative income tax of a serious sort, where the poor are raised up not by the very foolish minimum wage, which is orthodoxy in the Democratic Party, but by giving people money if we don't like the poverty that they have. If we were to say that, we would be able to sidestep the absurd claim that Cato or the libertarians are in favor of business and the Democrats are in favor of workers. Donald Trump is, of course, not really a conservative or a Republican. He's a populist. But that's his claim. He's going to help the workers by closing down trade, all kinds of trade. And this is a terrible, terrible mistake. So I think we've got to develop a positive program for laissez-faire.
Thank you for listening. Free Thoughts is produced by Evan Banks and Mark McDaniel. To learn more, find us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.